watches I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, or WXXC Truxton. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. The so-called war on terrorism didn't start after September 11th. It's been going on for more than 50 years. It's had many names: the Cold War, the Vietnam War, the Drug War, humanitarian intervention, or police actions. The war in Afghanistan would have happened even without the September 11th attacks. The blueprints for the invasion already existed. It just would have been packaged differently for us. War is always packaged in high moral terms: good and evil, defending democracy, or protecting human rights. But it's best understood in terms of costs and benefits. Who pays the costs and who benefits? Tonight on Unwelcome Guests, we'll take a look at the connection between money and war. In our first hour, journalist Bill Weinberg explains the wars presently being conducted in Latin America in the context of wars in Western Asia and how they're all connected to oil. In our second hour, an interview with two war tax resistors who are criminals in the eyes of the state because they refuse to kill or pay for killing.
Darkness and midnight, when the pot-bellied beasts chase their unwelcome guests.
Before we get into the topic of tonight's program, here's a holiday present for the Finger Lakes from the U.S. Forest Service. The U.S. Forest Service has issued a final report recommending that no drilling for gas take place in the Finger Lakes National Forest. Forest preservation activists say that this is the first time that this has happened in this region, and the head of the Forest Service for this region, Paul Brewster, has said that his decision was heavily influenced by the vigorous public response against drilling. U.S. Senators Clinton and Schumer reintroduced legislation on the 19th that would ban drilling in the forest permanently. This ban is supported by every member of Congress in the Finger Lakes, with the exception of Tom Reynolds, who misrepresents parts of Seneca, Cayuga, and Ontario counties. For more info, contact the Finger Lakes Forest Watch Congress on the web at flfwc.org, flfwc.org. Forest activists are suggesting sending thank you letters to Mr. Brewster and members of Congress Hinchey and Houghton, Senators Clinton and Schumer, and to Governor Pataki for their support in saving the forest. Addresses are available on the Finger Lakes Forest Watch Congress website. Okay, next we'll hear a talk by Bill Weinberg recorded earlier this month. Weinberg is a New York City-based radio and print journalist who has also authored several books on social movements in Latin America.
Originally, I was going to be talking mostly about Latin America, particularly about Colombia and Mexico and Central America, but we scheduled this before September 11th, and the wars for which we're being told are actually wars against narcotics. Now we're being told there are wars against terrorism in South America. As you know, the same wars are now going on the global stage as well. It's all linked. And this is coming directly from the State Department and from the government. They're saying that it's all one global counter-terrorist struggle now. So I would argue that this is World War III. I would argue that World War III has started. Start with a couple of interesting news clips about Colombia. This is very interesting. On September 10th, which some of us may recall was the day before September 11th, finally, after years and years of pressure from human rights organizations, the State Department added the Colombian Self-Defense, or the AUC, the AUC, to the official list of terrorist groups. which the State Department maintains. And as just as Secretary of State Colin Powell went down to Colombia to meet with President Andre Pastrana and talk about the next phase of Plan Colombia, the counterinsurgency war, which initially they were calling an anti-drug operation. And guess what they're calling it now since September 10th? Anybody?
Anti-terrorism.
Bingo. Okay. So, all right, so finally, of course, the left-wing guerrillas in Colombia, the FARC, the Colombian Revolutionary Armed Forces, and their minor league competition, the ELN, the National Liberation Army, had been on the State Department terrorist list for years and years and years. And despite the fact that while they are no angels by any stretch of the imagination, they don't come close to the AUC, which is the right-wing paramilitary network, in terms of sheer spectacular massacres and bloodshed. Obvious double standard at work, which had been protested by Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch for years and years and years. Finally, on September 10th of this year, Colin Powell goes down to Colombia, meets with Andre Pastrana. The trip is cut short because of what happens here in New York City the very next day, and Colin Powell announces that finally the AUC is going to be on the State Department terrorist list, which makes for good propaganda cover. Obviously, it's too little, too late. And the irony is, of course, that Human Rights Watch has actually identified the Colombian army units which are receiving aid from the United States through Plan Colombia, which are in turn passing the guns along to the AUC, to the paramilitary networks, which are, just massacring whole villages which are believed to support the guerrillas. So the AUC, even though it's now supposedly on the terrorist department list, is still actually receiving U.S. Guns, which are provided by U.S. tax dollars. Very ironic situation. Okay, then, are we to read this as merely a coincidence, too? This item appeared in the press from the UPI on September 11th, the very same day that the terrorist attacks took place here in New York City, quoting an anonymous terrorism expert from the State Department. Not a counter-narcotics expert, not even an expert on guerrilla warfare, but a terrorism expert from the State Department. The very same day that the attacks took place here in New York, September 11th, disappeared in the press from the UPI, saying that it is time, this is a quote, it is time to drop the fiction of anti-narcotics aid only in Colombia, and that Americans are the target of the country's two guerrilla groups, the Colombian Revolutionary Armed Forces, FARC, and the National Liberation Army, ELN. We no longer view the FARC and the ELN guerrillas as merely an internal threat to the security of Colombia, but as a threat to the security of the United States. We want the Colombian army to be able to go and get the bad guys wherever they are. We're talking about more direct military-to-military support, and a former, this one was actually quoted by name, former counterterrorism analyst for the Pentagon by the name of John Moore claims that Cubans, okay, that's an old trick, we know about the Cubans, but also Palestinians and Hezbollah, as well as advisors from Venezuela's government, the Hugo Chavez regime, are all aiding the Colombian guerrillas. And these comments came just as a 50-person U.S. security delegation, including Colin Powell, arrived in Colombia to meet with President Andre Pastrana to try to talk him into taking a harder line in combating the guerrillas. So they're officially dropping, same day that the terrorist attacks happened here in New York, the same day that they finally put the AUC on the anti-terrorism list so they can look like they have, a legitimate campaign against terrorism going, they also drop the charade that what they're doing in Colombia is merely an anti-narcotics law enforcement measure, and they're now admitting that it's actually about fighting the guerrillas, it's actually about counterinsurgency. And of course, now it's all in the guise of anti-terrorism, as opposed to an anti-drug operation. Now, whenever we see anything in the press which is quoting anonymous State Department officials, it always raises eyebrows because it's always the kind of thing which probably it's a leak, and probably it's an effort to change the nature of a political discourse and debate without really taking any responsibility for it. You have to look at the geography of the conflict to understand what the real resource issues which are in the background. They're not too far in the background either, if you pay any attention whatsoever. Probably almost all of us are aware of the situation with the Uwa Indians up here in Norte de Santander province on the eastern edge of the Andes in northern Colombia, actually in the rainforest of the Orinoco Basin, Orinoco River, in the northern part of Colombia. The Uwa Indians have been protesting for like 3 or 4 years now against a plan to take their ancestral lands and turn it over to, in fact, the Colombian government already has taken their ancestral lands and turned them over to Occidental Petroleum, a California-based oil company, in which Al Gore is a senior investor, and a big chunk of the Gore family fortune comes from. So he was hounded on the campaign trail by rainforest activists about his refusal to do anything to stop the forcible eviction of the Uwa Indians from their ancestral lands by Colombian army troops, which are backed up by U.S. tax dollars now to the tune of $3.5 billion under Plan Colombia for the profits of Occidental Petroleum, a U.S.-based corporation. Mm-hmm. And the Uwa Indians have erected their protest encampments on their traditional lands, which, you know, because their actual reservation, which they have under Colombian law, is just a fraction of their traditional lands, which were stolen from them. Just like Indians in this country, usually their reservations are just a postage stamp, you know, compared to what the original extent of their lands had been. And the army attacked these protest encampments, which the Uwa set up, and a few of them were actually killed in the confrontations which developed, and it actually made some press in this country. What hasn't made so much press is that there's a vast area in southern Colombia, in the Amazon basin, which is largely under the control of the FARC, or under the control of peasants, which are basically sympathetic to the FARC. And the reason they're sympathetic to the FARC is because the FARC is protecting their coca crops. And the coca crops are the only crops which they can grow, which will give them enough of a return to be able to feed their families. Because they're, you know, they've been pushed into the jungle by the corporate agribusiness interests, which are in the highlands where the fertile land is, and pushed into the jungle, and they can barely make a living. Poor soils in the jungle, as we all know. There's no roads, there's no infrastructure, no way to bring the crops to market, but the cocaine mafias will come there and actually take the coca crops out, so they don't need any roads. So the only way they can make enough money to feed their families is by growing coca crops, and and again, to the tune of $3.5 billion in U.S. tax dollars, the Colombian military is spraying herbicides all over the jungle, ostensibly to destroy the coca crops, really we believe is a counterinsurgency measure, and sending in troops to uproot the crops. So the FARC comes along and says, well, look, you know, you give us, you know, your young men to fight for us, is what they tell the peasants who grow the coca. You give us some young men to fight for us, and we'll protect your coca crops from the army. So this is what, you know, this has been the nature of the war here for a while. Now then the U.S. comes in with Plan Colombia, and they actually are calling for draining the sea, quote-unquote, which means the forced relocation of some 100,000 peasants out of this entire vast area of southern Colombia. Now, when this happens, when peasants are forcibly removed from their traditional homes at gunpoint by army or paramilitary troops, and it happens in Kosovo, and the perpetrator is the Serbian government, what do they call it? Thank you. When it happens in Colombia, when the U.S. is picking up the tax, when the U.S. tax dollars are picking up the tab for the whole thing, and the Pentagon and the State Department are intimately directing the whole thing, not only do they not call it ethnic cleansing, and not only do they fail to put it on the front page of the New York Times day after day after day after day after day, but it's not reported on at all. And in fact, there was one article which appeared in the San Jose Mercury News, the only article I've been able to find after extensive searches. There was one article on this which appeared in the San Jose Mercury News, which was based on briefing papers which the Pentagon had provided members of Congress in order to push through the Colombia aid package. And that was it. After that one article in not even a major newspaper in this country, it was down the so-called, you know, Orwellian memory hole. Never heard a word about it again. Okay, quite significant. The Plan Colombia is overwhelmingly focused on southern Colombia. It's overwhelmingly focused on fighting the FARC, which has control of the Amazon basin in southern Colombia. Practically nothing. I shouldn't say practically nothing at all in Plan Colombia, aside from some token measures in terms of judicial reform to make sure that the AUC, the right-wing paramilitaries, no longer have impunity and so on. But in terms of actual military action, nothing. Zero. Nothing in Plan Colombia is targeted towards the AUC. And the AUC, the right-wing paramilitary, their base of control is not here in the south. That's where they're attempting to make inroads, and they're fighting the FARC. But the area which is largely under their control and where the FARC is fighting them and trying to make inroads is in the north of Colombia. So it's not surprising that Plan Colombia is entirely targeted towards the south. Additionally, up here in the north, there's already a great deal of oil exploitation going on, primarily by Occidental Petroleum and British Petroleum. Okay, this entire region of the northern Amazon basin is filled with oil. There's already a lot of oil exploitation going on in Venezuela, has been for years. It's a major source of Venezuela's wealth. But now this oil is no longer, it's no longer reliable in terms of corporate access to it, because you've got the populist Hugo Chavez regime in power in Venezuela. Okay, then you've got the oil exploitation which is going on, primarily Occidental Petroleum in the Orinoco Basin in northern Colombia, and British Petroleum in the Chocó region on the other side of the Andes in northern Colombia. And you've got the problem with the guerrillas and the FARC, also not entirely secure. Okay, then going on down the Andean chain, here in the Oriente province of the Amazon basin of Ecuador, you've got Texaco and Occidental Petroleum again are exporting oil here. And in fact, the Occidental Petroleum recently secured a contract from the Ecuadorian government to build an oil pipeline over the Andes from the Amazon basin to the port of Manta on the Pacific coast. And this was the Ecuadorian government agreed to this under heavy pressure from the World Bank as a condition of rescheduling their debt. So and as another condition was that they had to agree to dollarization of the economy and actually phasing out the Ecuadorian national currency in favor of the dollar, in favor of the U.S. greenback. So, but here, this has also sparked the backlash, particularly the dollarization plan has also sparked the backlash, and two times in as many years, in the last 2 years, there has been a nationwide, largely unarmed, civil Indian uprising in Ecuador, and public buildings have been taken over throughout the country, and the roads have been blockaded, and so on. So if they're going to efficiently be able to exploit this oil, they've got to militarize the entire region and get it under control. So also in the name of fighting the FARC guerrillas, they're also bringing U.S. troops into military bases which are now being built along the Colombian border in Ecuador. And finally, there's this big gap in the region of oil exploitation. They've got Venezuela, been under development for generations. More recently, they brought northern Colombia safely under the control of the paramilitaries, even though the paramilitaries are ostensibly outlawed, ostensibly on the State Department list. In reality, they're what's keeping things under control in northern Colombia. And now, they're increasing exploitation in Ecuador as well. But there's still this sea of oil, which is lying under the southern Colombian Amazon basin region, which now is being ethnically cleansed by the paramilitaries working hand in glove with the Colombian military, working hand in glove with the Pentagon and the Green Berets, and all these military advisors are actually intimately directing the ethnic cleansing which is going on down there right now. Okay, and this new pipeline which they're building over the Andes to get the oil from the Ecuadorian Amazon to international market. We thought that the trade barriers were going down and the barriers between natural resources and labor in the Americas and corporate power which wants to exploit it, we thought they were going down fast under NAFTA and Free Trade Area of the Americas and World Trade Organization and all that stuff before the terrorist attacks. Or you ain't seen nothing yet. It's about to vastly accelerate because now anybody who opposes it is a threat to national security and a... Thank you. All right. A week after the attacks, U.S. Trade Representative Robert Zoellick argued in the Washington Post that giving Bush fast-track authority for expanding the free trade area of the Americas, which means limiting congressional input on the trade negotiations, was an imperative response to the terrorist attacks. Earlier enemies learned that America is the arsenal of democracy, Zoellick wrote. Today's enemies will learn that America is the economic engine for freedom, opportunity, and development. To that end, U.S. leadership in promoting the international economic and trading system is vital. Trade is about more than economic efficiency. It promotes the values that are at the heart of this protected struggle against terrorism. That same week, Senator Frank Murkowski of Alaska announced that the terrorist attacks mandated opening the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to the oil industry. Quote, "There is no doubt at this time of national emergency, an expedited energy security bill must be considered," he told the press. "Opening the ANWR will be the central element in finally reducing the country's dangerous overdependence on unstable foreign sources of energy." Legislators immediately added amendments to the Emergency Defense Authorization Bill, which would open the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to exploitation. And I believe that that is still pending. Interestingly, just before the terrorism crisis banished all of the news from the headlines, it was reported that the destruction of South America's Amazon rainforest, which scientists had recently believed to be slowing due to the demarcation of traditional indigenous lands and cracks down on illegal resource exploitation, was once again rapidly accelerating. Deforestation of the Amazon basin jumped in 2000 to the highest level since 1995, according to a study by Brazil's National Institute for Space Research. Some 12 to 20% of the Amazon has already been deforested or significantly degraded, and a new joint study by Brazil's National Institute of Amazon Research and the University of Michigan, recently published in Science, found that if road building and industrial development continue apace, as little as 5% of the original forest cover would survive by the year 2050. But, you know, we're not allowed to talk about that anymore, just like we're not allowed to talk about saving the ANWR anymore, because now it's all a question of national emergency and national security. So the plans which were sort of on hold before the terrorism crisis hit are now galloping forward once again. And among these plans are a whole series in order to bring the resources, not just of the Amazon basin, but of all of South and Latin America online in terms of corporate access, are a whole series of interoceanic trade routes. Because now, you know, the Panama Canal has largely outlived its usefulness. It doesn't accommodate modern super tankers. And most ironically of all, the Panama Canal is rapidly becoming a worthless ditch because the freshwater locks which enable the ships to pass through, there's no more fresh water available for them because of deforestation in Panama. And the watersheds are going, and the locks are filling up with siltation. So basically the Panama Canal is rapidly approaching obsolescence. So they need to find some different trade routes. And the first one is that British Petroleum has got a plan to build one through Colombia, right here just below the Panamanian border through the Chocó region. And the local indigenous peoples there, actually the Afro-Colombians in Chocó province, who have their own constitutionally mandated autonomous region there in Colombia, are dead set against the idea. And they have recently been meeting with terror at the hands of the AUK and its paramilitary minions there to try to terrorize them back into submission. And if they're busy, if they have their hands filled trying to get attention to the human rights situation and trying to get their disappeared and murdered, get some justice for their disappeared and assassinated leaders, they're going to have their hands too busy to fight the pipeline plan. And not surprisingly, it's also been documented by the human rights organizations that the British Petroleum, has hired security firms, private security firms, to watch over their oil operations there. Private security firms, which are in bed with the AUK, with the right-wing paramilitaries, and have actually been getting guns from the AUK and actually overlap with the AUK, which in turn gets guns from and overlaps with the Colombian military, active duty military, which in turn is being intimately directed and funded by the Pentagon and the State Department. Okay, moving up the isthmus, almost every one of these, almost every country in Central America now has got a plan for either a new canal or a so-called dry canal, which is just an interoceanic trade link, super highways and new rail lines with free trade zones and industrial pods on either side. Obviously, Panama wants to build a new one. They want to build it right through the Darien rainforest. Costa Rica has got a plan to build one right across the northern part of Costa Rica here. And they're competing with Nicaragua, which wants to build one across southern Nicaragua. Because, you know, you've got the San Juan River here, which links up to the Lake Nicaragua. And then you've just got this very, very narrow little strip of land there. And you've got a sea link, which connects you from the Pacific to the Atlantic. And then, finally, you've got the plan, the two projects which they want to build through Mexico. One across the Isthmus of Tehuantepec, from Coatzacoalcos, Veracruz, to Salina Cruz, Oaxaca, where there's already a rail line. They want to build a much bigger rail line and super highways and, you know, the industrial pods, containerized shipping facilities, oil exploitation, mega-scale hydro development, etc., on either side as well. And then they want to build one which would actually be some kind of rail line going from Veracruz through Puebla to, I believe, Acapulco or somewhere on the Pacific coast. That plan is still kind of vague. And President Vicente Fox, as probably some of you are aware, is calling this the Puebla-Panama plan, because he doesn't want to just do one of these. He wants to do all of them and turn Mexico into, you know, a major free trade power broker for the entire Central American region. And Mexico would be the conduit for gringo capital to flow into Central America to build these to build these new interoceanic trade links. And of course, the indigenous peoples whose land are going to be stolen and destroyed and degraded by these mega industrial projects are all dead set against it. And particularly in southern Oaxaca here, where they want to build the terminal for the Trans-Tehuantepec trade route, you've got the Mixtec and Zapotec Indians have got the extremely militant organizations which have really upped the whole level of the struggle in Oaxaca ever since the Zapatista Rebellion began in Chiapas in 1994. And they've been taking over municipal governments and staging their own local insurrections and pressing their demands for greater democracy. Now, what you would grasp from reading the media reports in this country is that now, you know, democracy has been restored to Mexico now that the one-party dictatorship has been ousted with the election of President Vicente Fox. And it has to be said that Vicente Fox has been playing his cards very, very well. And probably some of you are aware that Rodolfo Montiel, who was actually an indigenous radical environmentalist leader from the state of Guerrero, right here, one state up the isthmus from Oaxaca, who was actually blockading the logging roads where the U.S.-based corporation Boise Cascade was, they went with NAFTA, they closed their logging mills in the Pacific Northwest in this country and moved them down to Guerrero and started exploiting the land there. And just like Earth First was blockading the logging roads up in Washington and Idaho and Oregon, Rodolfo Montiel and his Mixtec comrades began blockading the logging roads in Guerrero. And finally, they were, about 2 years ago, they were framed on marijuana charges, on charges of growing marijuana, and convicted and locked up. And this was protested once again by Amnesty International, all the other human rights groups who said that they'd been denied a fair trial, that also one of his comrades, a man by the name of Cabrera, can't remember his first name, Montiel and Cabrera had been denied a fair trial, and it was protested internationally by all the environmental groups and human rights groups, but the old regime under the Institutional Revolutionary Party was unwilling to budge, and Fox was unwilling to budge until just this week. Finally, he did budge, probably because the lawyer who had defended Montiel Cabrera and his comrades, a woman by the name of Digna Ochoa, was assassinated last week. And there was a big outcry about this, and it really looked bad, and it was almost certainly people linked to the army or the security forces who were responsible for it. So under the pressure, Vicente Fox announced that Montiel and Cabrera were to be released. Nonetheless, despite the fact that Fox is very shrewd and is playing his cards very well, his overt agenda, not even, you know, a hidden agenda, his overt agenda, with the Puebla-Panama plan being sort of the cutting edge, his overt agenda calls for breaking up the communal lands of the Indians and the peasants in Mexico, privatizing everything, turning all of the resources which are traditionally in the hands and legally, constitutionally in Mexico, in the hands of local indigenous communities, privatizing all that land off to the and all those resources off to the highest corporate bidder, highest multinational corporate bidder, and the resources which are at play here, you know, once again, timber, like Boise Cascade, just the agricultural wealth of the land for, growing coffee or beef or whatnot, and finally, oil. Of course, the biggest thorn in the side of this whole free trade scheme for the certainly for southern Mexico and probably for greater Mesoamerica, including Central America, possibly for the entire hemisphere, is the fact that you've still got the Zapatista National Liberation Army in the Lacandon Selva, which is the rainforest region of Chiapas. And despite the initial pledge, which helped get Fox elected, that he was going to sign the peace accords and give and agree to the Zapatistas' demands for constitutional reforms, which would grant the indigenous peoples constitutional autonomy in Mexico. As we're probably all aware, when these plans actually went to Congress, they were gutted, and all of the real binding provisions which called for territorial control of land and resources in the hands of the local indigenous communities, all of those provisions were eliminated. So the accords were gutted, and Fox signed them anyway, and the Zapatistas broke off dialogue, and we're back to square one, and it's like nothing has changed in Chiapas since before the election. And interestingly, the oil industry in Latin America began at the turn of the century in the hands of Standard Oil, today Exxon, up here in Tampico, in Tamaulipas and Veracruz region. And probably, again, as most of us are aware, in 1938, the oil industry, with the oil resources were nationalized by the Mexican government, and subsequently, the industry began to expand down the Gulf Coast to the state of Tabasco, which is the heartland of the Mexican oil industry today, and the rainforest in Tabasco, which just a generation ago was contiguous with the rainforest in Chiapas, the Lacandon Selva, has now been completely destroyed by the state oil company Pemex. And in the whole wave of privatization which followed NAFTA, just about everything in Mexico was, which had been in the hands of the state, was sold off to private interests. You know, the airports and telecommunications and the rail lines and just about all of the resources. And finally, the ejidos, the communal lands, where, you know, the constitution was changed to allow them to be privatized. The last, you know, the last thing which remains in public hands, which is yet to be privatized in Mexico, is the oil sector. And they're sneaking around to that as well. They've already opened up the energy sector. They're calling for privatization of the electrical grid and so on. And the next plan for expansion of the oil industry is down into Chiapas. And in fact, that was where, after they developed Tabasco in the 1970s, the plan was to develop the Lacandon Selva and Chiapas for oil in the 1980s. The reason they didn't was because the peso crashed in 1983. And they were getting ready to resurrect those plans a decade later in anticipation of NAFTA in 1993 when all of a sudden, January 1st, 1994, the Zapatista revolt happens. But they believe they still have, this is still the agenda. As soon as they can get Chiapas under control, they're going to, this is definitely still the plan, is to get those resources, those oil resources in the Lacandon Selva, and this time not in the under the auspices of Pemex and the Mexican state, but once again under the auspices of Standard Oil, who they kicked out back in 1938, or Occidental Petroleum, or what have you, somebody of that ilk. So, I don't have a crystal ball. I can't tell what's going to happen in the future, but there's every reason to be suspicious about the sort of sanguine attitude that Fox is bringing peace and democracy to Mexico. And one of the most ominous signals is, once again, immediately after the September 11th attacks, the Mexican Attorney General goes on television and says that he's just found out that, okay, in addition to the Zapatistas now, there's also guerrilla groups which have always refused to talk with the government and style themselves as more radical and hardcore than the Zapatistas, more Marxist-Leninist, more doctrinaire, mostly in Guerrero and Oaxaca, like the EPR, the Popular Revolutionary Army. So the day after the the day after the terrorist attacks here in New York, the Mexican Attorney General goes on TV and says, okay, we've discovered evidence that the EPR and other Mexican guerrilla groups are working with the Palestinians and Hezbollah and blah, 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 blah. So they are gearing up for a Latin offensive.
Have we seen any of this evidence yet?
No, of course not. They're gearing up for a Latin offensive, as it were, in World War III. Are they going to get away with it? I don't know. If we do our homework here in the United States and try to organize an effective peace movement, which is where, you know, I'd like to bring the discussion after I finish spewing here, maybe they won't get away with it. But it's definitely something to be concerned with. And now to bring this to, finally, we'll look at the more global picture. All this Latin America stuff, as far as the ruling elites in this country are concerned, it's a sideshow. Because the only reason they want the oil which is in Mexico, the oil which is in Colombia, the oil which is in Alaska, the only reason they want that oil is to make money. And that's a big incentive, and they definitely want that oil, and they will be extremely ruthless in their methods of getting their hands on it. But it's driven pretty strictly by greed. It's driven pretty strictly by the profit motive. Now, the oil, in contrast, which is in the Caspian Sea region, they don't just need that oil so that they can make a mint. They need that oil for geostrategic purposes. Zbigniew Ziobrinski, former national security advisor, and now elder statesman with the Council on Foreign Relations, and one of these people who sort of makes policy behind the scenes, as he puts it, global primacy is the prize, and the playing field is Eurasia. They need to get this oil because whoever is going to control Central Asia and these oil resources is effectively going to control the world. And there has been, in the Western mind, this stuff goes really deep, in the Western mind for, you know, thousands of years, there has been a deep-seated fear of this part of the world because it has never been under the control of any empires until very, very recently. And in fact, you know, throughout the history, the empires which have established themselves on the fringe of Eurasia, on the rim, on the literal, so to speak, the empires of, you know, Rome and the Arab world and India and China and, you know, and of Europe generally, you know, after the, you know, Middle Ages, have been, you know, these empires have been destroyed, as we know, time and time and time again by, you know, outbursts of Huns and Mongols and other and other nomadic peoples from the steppes of Central Eurasia. And even bringing this into modern times, you know, the great dictators of the 20th century understood the significance of this region. Okay, the Soviets began to develop the oil on the west side of the Caspian Sea in Azerbaijan in the 1920s. In 1941, when Hitler risked everything, and ultimately it proved to be a completely disastrous move for him, when he risked everything by blowing it with his ally Stalin and invading Russia, it was to get his hands on this oil, because that was the only way that he could hope to win the war, because the U.S. and Britain had an inexhaustible supply of oil from Venezuela at that time. The only way that Hitler could win the war was by getting his hands on this oil, which is why he risked everything and ultimately completely blew it by invading Russia, was to get his hands on this oil. Stalin responded immediately in an extremely ambitious move, which ultimately proved to be extremely successful. All of, you know, Russia's industry at that point was in European Russia, on the west side of the Urals. Immediately after the invasion in 1941, Stalin moved all of the industrial infrastructure of Russia across the Ural Mountains into Central Asia. And the Nazis never made it across those mountains. They got as far as Stalingrad, and they never made it across those mountains. And eventually, you know, Russia was able to rebuild their power and chase the Nazis all the way back to Berlin, as we know. So finally, the Soviet Empire is pushed to the point of collapse in the 1980s, late 1980s, early 1990s. And this was, once again, affected through this very same region, through the CIA backing the Mujahideen rebels in Afghanistan. And particularly, beginning in 1985, the director of the CIA, Bill Casey, comes up with a plan to actually get the Mujahideen to make raids across the border into what was then the Soviet Union, into Uzbekistan, into Tajikistan, and to start arming guerrilla movements within the Soviet Union, not only in Afghanistan, which was occupied by the Soviet Union, but actually within the Soviet Union. And ultimately, the Soviets were, this was a hemorrhage of the Soviet Union's wealth, the military campaign in Afghanistan. And it was they suffered from imperial overstretch, also with Star Wars, which was Reagan's strategic bid to push the Soviets over the edge by spending them into collapse, and it worked. Now it's over 10 years later, and the question is now it's time to develop all the oil which is on the eastern side of the Caspian Sea, which the Soviets never got around to developing. The key question. Until very recently, everything changed with September 11th, but until very recently, the key strategic aim, which was spoken about fairly openly by the likes of Zbigniew Ziobrinsky and the Council on Foreign Relations and so on, was to make sure that this oil was going to be in the hands of Western corporations. And not only so Western corporations could make a mint, but also so that it quite significantly would not be in the hands of the Russians. And that the Russian Empire would never be able to get their hands on that oil, never be able to rebuild themselves, never again be able to threaten the West. So in 1995, the first of the oil contracts is signed between the post-Soviet Central Asian nations and Western companies. The first one was between the government of Kazakhstan and the Chevron Corporation. The deal was brokered by executive from the oil resources firm Halliburton, who happened to be sitting on the Kazakhstan National Oil Advisory Board at that time. He's the one who brokered the deal between the government of Kazakhstan and the and Chevron. Anybody guess what his name was?
Cheney.
Dick Cheney. Very good, Dick Cheney. Then Unocal steps in. Texas-based firm Unocal steps in, starts negotiating with the government of Turkmenistan to develop oil on their share of the Caspian Sea over here. And they hire, in order to help broker the deal and to help smooth negotiations over with the government of Turkmenistan and to help get investment and so on, they hire another former National Security Advisor of the United States, who at this moment happens to be wanted in Belgium for war crimes. Sharon. Happens to be wanted in France for war crimes. Anybody take a wild guess who that was? Henry Kissinger. Very good. All right, so you've got Cheney brokering the deal with Kazakhstan. You've got Henry Kissinger brokering the deal with Turkmenistan. The next, after they sign those deals, the next question is, how are we going to get this... how are we going to get all this oil to market? How are we going to get all this oil to Western markets? Okay. The original pipeline, which the Soviets had built, connecting the oil fields of Azerbaijan to Russia, went through Chechnya, interestingly enough. And finally, 1997, Russia had to build at great cost, which they could really not afford, but they had no choice. They had to build the Chechen bypass pipeline through neighboring Dagestan because the guerrillas in Chechnya kept on blowing up the pipeline. And then as soon as they finished building the Chechen bypass pipeline through Dagestan, then the Chechen guerrillas started arming their pals in Dagestan, and the Islamic guerrillas in Dagestan started blowing up the pipeline as well. So essentially, the Russians were not looking too good in terms of being able to get their oil in Azerbaijan to market. Interestingly enough, who was backing the Chechen rebels and the Dagestan rebels at this point? Somebody who had quite a history of working with the CIA in Afghanistan before he decided to turn against us. Very good. It's an imperative that Russia not get a cut of this oil so that Russia cannot recover. So they need other pipeline routes.
The only way is through Iran.
Well, yeah. In fact, they're talking about building one through Iran, except that Iran is too cozy with Russia. Iran has been getting too cozy with Russia throughout this whole thing because of the internal politics in Afghanistan, And the fact that, you know, Pakistan, which is still being backed by the United States and the CIA, was covertly backing the Taliban, because the Taliban was backing the was fighting the Northern Alliance, which was being fought by Russia. So this forced India and Iran into the hands of the Russians, because they're enemies of Pakistan, and also because the Shiites in Afghanistan, who share the same religion as the Iranians, were being ethnically cleansed by the Taliban, which was being covertly backed by the CIA at this point. Again, this whole alliance changed dramatically with September 11th. We'll get to that in just a minute. So, yeah, they couldn't very well build it through Iran. So that leaves two options. Okay, first, the Russians start talking with Kazakhstan about building a second route through Russia, delivering the oil from Kazakhstan through Russia. As soon as they do that, Chevron turns around and says, well, look, we've got to beat them to the punch. And of course we can do it, because we have superior access to resources and capital. We have to beat them to the punch. Chevron forms a conglomerate which would actually build a pipeline under the Caspian Sea to Baku, to Azerbaijan, across Azerbaijan, Georgia, Turkey, to Istanbul, and get the oil to market that way. Of course, with some serious problems, because you're going through at least three different war zones. There's a war going on in between Azerbaijan and Armenia. There's a war going on in Georgia between Georgia and Abkhazia. And then you've got the war which is going on in eastern Turkey between the Turks and the Kurds. Nonetheless, capital started pouring in for this project. And that, in fact, is the project which is going ahead the fastest. So you've now got, you know, you've got Russia racing with Chevron to build their two different pipeline routes. Then there's the third pipeline route. There's the Unocal pipeline route. And the Unocal pipeline route was going to go through Afghanistan and down to Pakistan to Karachi. And in order to bring this about, who did they have to deal with in Afghanistan? Obviously the people who were in power in Afghanistan, which was the Taliban. So at the same time that Madeleine Albright, our Secretary of State under the Clinton administration, was going on TV and speaking in front of Congress and saying that the Taliban are a bunch of terrorists and they're totalitarian and they oppress women, which is true. At the same time, the State Department was allowing Taliban leaders to come to Dallas, Texas, to meet with executives of Occidental in their corporate headquarters and to actually sign on the dotted line allowing Unocal to build their pipeline through Afghanistan. So, it was in Sugarloaf, Texas, which is right outside Dallas-Fort Worth. And this was also at the same time, if fairly credible reports which appeared in the press in India are to be believed, that, okay, it's certain, this is not conjecture, it's certain that the ISI, which is the Inter-Services Intelligence Division of Pakistan, Pakistan's secret police, were pouring lots of money into the Taliban. And there was a great deal of speculation, which makes a certain amount of sense if you look at it geostrategically, that the CIA was continuing to pour money into EC to arm the Taliban, just as they had during the 1980s been pouring money into EC to arm the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. So that was the situation, completely sleazy, duplicitous situation, up until September 11th. Okay, well, September 11th, and I'm going to wrap it up here, and then we'll take a break and talk. September 11th, finally, the Bush administration apparently says, you know, enough is enough, we got to get rid of these Taliban, we can't deal with these Taliban. So now, all of a sudden, Russia becomes our ally, and the U.S. is granted access to military bases in Uzbekistan and Tajikistan, Russian military bases, Soviet-built military bases in Uzbekistan and Tajikistan, in order to help fight the Taliban. So, and the U.S. is now backing the Northern Alliance, which had previously been backed by Russia to fight the Taliban, which had been backed by Pakistan and the United States. So, it's kind of like the shifting alliances in George Orwell's 1984. Eurasia has always been at war with East Asia. East Asia has always been at war with Eurasia. Blah, blah, blah. A post-Orwellian situation. But the alliances are ripe for shifting again, okay? Because this is seen particularly by Russia, particularly by the Kremlin, as an alliance of convenience, okay? The Taliban has been, you know, arming these guerrilla groups, these Islamic guerrilla groups in Uzbekistan, in Tajikistan, in Chechnya, and actually within the former Soviet Union. So obviously they want to get rid of the Taliban. And right now they see Islamic extremism as a greater threat to Russian imperialism than United States imperialism. However, once, if we're going to be optimistic, the Taliban is defeated, which may not be that easy. Once the threat of Islamic extremism is defeated, then all of a sudden Russia may not be too happy about the fact that not only have they lost control of the Caspian Basin to U.S. oil companies and to Islamic guerrillas, now they've also lost control of the area to the U.S. military. And then what used to be Soviet military bases in Tajikistan and Uzbekistan have now become de facto U.S. military bases. They're not going to be too happy about that. So the alliance is ripe to shift again. So the two things which we have to look for in the immediate future is, okay, we just found out, took me totally by surprise, that Kabul, the capital of Afghanistan, has been abandoned by the Taliban as of yesterday. Not as significant as it might seem because really the Taliban power base in Afghanistan is not the capital, Kabul, but Kandahar, which is where the Taliban the de facto capital as opposed to the official capital.
The heartland,
exactly, the Taliban heartland. So it may not be all that significant, but in any case,
it's their fruited plain.
Exactly. In any case, you've got the Northern Alliance, which is now being backed by both the U.S. and Russia, is basically made up of Tajiks and Uzbeks and ethnic peoples from the north. And as we all know, the Taliban is mostly made up of Pashtuns, ethnic peoples from the south. And throughout this war, there have been absolutely horrific incidents of ethnic cleansing, which have been committed on both sides, which really put what was going on in Bosnia to shame. But never got nearly as much press coverage because it wasn't happening in Europe. So things could really spin out of control in a very ugly way in Afghanistan. So we've got to look out for this. We also have to look out for, once again, a falling out between the U.S. and Russia when the hardliners start to move against Putin, or when it looks like the U.S. military presence in the Caspian Basin is starting to look too permanent. Once again, we could see a return to renewed U.S.-Russian tensions over access to the Caspian Basin and control of the entire goddamn planet in the 21st century.
That was journalist Bill Weinberg speaking earlier this month in New York City.
You're listening to Unwelcome Guests on WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner, Syracuse.
The interview we're about to hear with Wally and Juanita Nelson aired in 1998 on an African-American AM talk radio station in Birmingham, Alabama. The first voice you'll hear is that of Shelley Stewart, host of The Academy of Common Sense.